listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Thanks for downloading the show. I'm Rob Daly. This week, Barcelona are beaten by struggling Valencia. A third loss in a row in La Liga has blown the Spanish title race wide open. We speak to beIN Sport and Eurosport journalist Jonathan Johnson to discuss Laurent Blanc's future with Paris Saint-Germain after their Champions League exit. Portuguese football journalist Tom Kundert is here to discuss the battle in Lisbon to be crowned champions. And BT Sport commentator Adam Summerton will be telling us how AC Milan got their first win under new head coach Christian Brocchi.
This is Football in Europe.
No Chris Parrott this week. Chris is away. So Adam Summerton has joined us to help get things started. Adam, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you've had to bribe someone with the promise of biscuits to keep them quiet during the recording of your section of the show.
Yeah, I've got my four-year-old daughter with me, and she's been given an iPad to play on and the promise of if she keeps quiet while we do this, she can have some biscuits. So we'll see if that works.
All right, we'll see how that goes. So at the weekend, we'll talk about La Liga very briefly, the Champions League draw, because Barcelona were beaten by Valencia, and it means it's all level at the top in La Liga. Barca level on points with Atletico, Real Madrid 1 point behind them. Barcelona really abject in the latter stages of that performance against Valencia. And it's a real collapse, three league defeats in a row. And Adam, we were working together on the game against Atletico, but they were knocked out, out of the Champions League. How surprised are you by this sort of drop-off in Barcelona in terms of their Champions League challenge and their title challenge?
Well, I think extremely surprised. We had so many conversations earlier in the season, even up until, less than a month ago, where we were saying, look, we can't see anybody being able to stop this front three, particularly over two legs in the Champions League. But, you know, that's all gone out the window and they've just had this real dip in form. The thing that was really noticeable for me in hindsight from the game against Atleti in terms of Messi, who I know ended that mini drought that he's been having at the weekend, but it was how deep he was playing in that game against Atleti. Just wasn't able to influence things, partly because of Atletico's excellent defending, by the way. But also, as I say, I just felt that he was playing very deep, just not the same. We're told that maybe he's carrying an injury. I noticed as well how Neymar was getting really frustrated all the time. I think we saw a bit of that against Valencia as well, when things aren't quite clicking, when a bit of the petulance comes out. And that's not going to help. But sort of pinpointing the reasons for it are difficult, aren't they? But clearly, you know, when Messi's off his game, that is going to influence things. But you would think with the quality that they have around him that they would be able to overcome that. But they're in an incredibly difficult spell and it's almost unthinkable, isn't it, that they could throw away the La Liga title. But now just a point separating the top three. So it's a distinct possibility.
We've asked for people's tweets on the best title race in Europe at the moment. And no surprise, La Liga, because of the nature that the size of the clubs and everything and how tight it is. Mancini scarf one of those to tweet in to say La Liga, tight three-horse race. Elliot Rothwell, a favourite of the show, meanwhile, has tweeted us a picture of the top of the Russian Premier League table where no less than five teams still have a chance of winning the league with six games to go. Adam, let's talk about the Champions League draw very briefly before we talk about your number one love, Syria. what do you make to the Champions League last four?
Intriguing, isn't it? Yeah, I'm expecting a high-scoring tie, I think, between Real Madrid and Manchester City. I saw the problems that Roma, I remember, caused Real Madrid defensively at the Bernabeu. If they'd been more clinical that night, Roma could have scored two or three goals. Had some excellent chances, and Wolfsburg, of course, beat them in Germany 2-0. So, you know, I can see City causing them problems, you know, with De Bruyne back in. I just think he improves City massively, injects that pace and quality in the final third. And I think that's helping Aguero as well. There's that narrative too, Rob, with Aguero, a former Atleti player, up against Real Madrid. You know, a club that he's been linked with in the past. I don't know if there was any truth in it, but you know, he has been linked with Real Madrid in the past. And then we've got the Pellegrini narrative as well, up against his former club, Real Madrid. I thought he was a little bit unlucky to be let go then. That was when Mourinho came in, wasn't it? So he'll play that down. He'll say he doesn't want revenge, but I would be surprised. Yeah, I'd be surprised if it wasn't in the back of his mind. And Zidane, I mean, Rob, how good is this guy? I don't know. Even by the end of this season, I don't think we'll really know at all. The second leg in Madrid gives, for me, the Spanish side a slight edge, but it's going to be a great tie, that one.
Yeah, some brilliant ties in Europe on the way, of course, and the Europa League semi-finals. Adam, let's talk Serie A, because on Sunday night you were commentating on Christian Brocchi's first game in charge of the Milan first team and a victory at Sampdoria. Would it be fair to say it wasn't the prettiest of wins, but a winning start nonetheless for him?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. It was Milan's first win in six. They really needed it. The last had been at the end of February. Brocchi off to a winning start. The only goal, it was scored 71 minutes in by Carlos Bacca, who I say Milan needed a win. He needed a goal. He'd gone, I think he'd only scored 1 in 8 before that game, and he'd missed an earlier chance trying a really elaborate Rabona, which didn't come off and didn't look great, actually, when it would have been, for a player of his quality, fairly simple finish, you would have thought, with his left, but yeah. He tried the Rabona. And it didn't work out. He was set up by Bonaventura. Again, that will please Brocchi. It will please their teammates, because his form has dipped in recent weeks. He's been excellent for much of the season, but has just seen a bit of a dip in form. Sampdoria, we're not happy with the referee. They had a goal disallowed for offside in the first half. That they felt should have stood. I actually think the decision was probably right, although it was a very tight call. And they also felt that they should have been awarded a free kick in the build-up to Milan's goal. So there were protests from Sampdoria at the end of the game, but Milan just about sneaked over the line.
So what do we expect to see? And what is the objective for Brocchi with these 2 months in charge? I mean, it's barely any time at all.
Well, I think it's an audition for him, isn't it, to see if he can get the job beyond the end of this season. I think he's a clear favourite of Silvio Berlusconi, and at Milan, that takes you a long way, I think. And he's Milan's fifth coach in 3 seasons. I did have to laugh when I read an interview with Cesare Prandelli, his former coach at Verona, who was one of many people interviewed and asked for opinions on this appointment. And having coached Brocchi as a player at Verona, he was said, "What advice would you have for him?" And he said, "Well, when he speaks to Silvio Berlusconi, just say, 'Yes, sir.'" And I think that although that was said tongue-in-cheek, it is actually quite close to the reality, yeah. I think, because that was one of the problems with Mihailovic. I think that there was clearly a clash of personalities between him and Mihailovic, maybe even Galliani as well, I'm not sure. But but that puzzled me with Mihailovic, because Berlusconi clearly must have known that when he hired Mihailovic, he wasn't hiring a yes man. So, you know, anybody who'd done any due diligence on Mihailovic would have known that. So that surprised me that seemed to bother Silvio Berlusconi. But I think my own view on Mihailovic is that I think that it's a mistake. I think that he'd done a pretty good job. I don't really know what more he was expected to achieve in his first season. It looks as though they'll finish in the top six. He's got them to a cup final, their first Coppa Italia final in 13 seasons. So, you know, and there are shoots of growth there. Donnarumma has been introduced into the team. I think Niang, before he broke his ankle or damaged his ankle.
He was looking good.
He was, and the team was looking good, Rob. And I think we should actually bring that up, because that, for me, was a big turning point. Because up to that point, I think Milan had gone 12 games unbeaten. He'd finally settled on a system. They were playing 4-4-2. Niang was a good foil for Bacca. Bonaventura was playing well. Honda was playing well on the other flank. Kutzka in central midfield, Montolivo. There was a balance about the team for the first time. And it was just such a shame that obviously he damaged his ankle, because it just seemed to, from that point, they've struggled to get that sort of balance back in the side. And eventually Mihailovic has gone. But, you know, as I say, fifth coach in 3 seasons. And to sum it up, I think what is a glorious history for Milan continues to spoil the club's future at the moment, because everything is judged not on the present, but on the past, in my view. And that can never be a recipe for success going forward, I don't think.
Well, speaking of Milan's past, Mario Balotelli was a player brought back with sort of romantic intentions that he would come back and be a hero for the Rossoneri again. It hasn't happened. He says he doesn't want to go back to Liverpool this week, Adam. And I suspect Jurgen Klopp isn't particularly a fan of someone with his work rate. He got good reviews for his performance against Juventus. I wasn't actually that impressed personally, and I think his work rate is partly down to that. But there have been relatively positive reviews of his performances. What have you thought of Balotelli of late? And do you think he stands any chance of earning that deal that Adriano Galliani has said is not happening at the moment, as things stand?
Well, Galliani has said, and to quote him, that Balotelli has a crazy desire to stay at Milan. But Galliani has also said that Balotelli simply hasn't done enough yet. to earn a contract with Milan, and he's running out of time to be able to convince them that he deserves to stay. I think you're spot on about Liverpool. I just can't see him fitting in under Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool. He scored one Serie A goal all season. He's had back-to-back starts in Serie A, which has been a rarity for him this season. But I like you, I think that his performances have been a little overrated in those two games. I don't think he's done a massive amount. He was very wasteful from free kicks last night. He had four in very good positions, about 25 yards out.
He was doing that a lot at Liverpool when he was desperately trying to score a goal. He was taking every free kick and missing every single one.
Yeah, I think he just wants that moment, doesn't he, to sort of... He does rely a little bit on confidence, Mario Balotelli, despite the fact that he can produce that moment of genius. I just have a little bit of a theory on Balotelli, actually, just partly on what I saw last night. I did the game with Stuart Robson, and we were chatting about how the way Balotelli was being used. And it was almost like it just looked like he'd been told to go out and just basically not do what he wanted, but there didn't seem to be any real tactical requirements on him. He was popping up all over the place. He wasn't getting close enough to Bakka, in my view, for them to link up effectively. That was clearly a problem, although there will be a lack of understanding there. But I just wonder whether Mario Balotelli is the sort of player who needs a coach who will instill or require more tactical discipline from him. I think that could actually work in favour of Balotelli because people have always, I think, looked at Balotelli and said he's a bit of a maverick. He can produce a moment of genius. And with those sort of players, we look at them and we say, well, just let them go out and express themselves.
Let them play.
I actually think Balotelli's at the point of his career where that's actually going against him. I think he needs somebody to almost educate him, to almost try and mould him and say, look, yes, we know you've got this quality, but we think you can do it more in a team framework and with a tactical responsibility and to fit into a team ethic more. You know, I that's just a personal view. That's what I see.
I think that's a really good point. I'd go along with that.
I just see a player who's almost a little bit lost, is wandering around a little bit aimlessly and hoping that he can produce that moment of quality that will suddenly have everybody saying, oh, Mario, you're brilliant, just go out and play. I actually think he needs, as I say, that someone to get hold of him and say, this is what I want you to do. This is your job today.
There are midweek fixtures in Italy this week. Milan take on Carpi. Lazio off the back of a couple of wins under new head coach Simone Inzaghi. They go to Juventus. Juventus beating Palermo 4-0, so they're 9 points clear because, Adam, you were commentating for BT Sport on Napoli's defeat at the hands of Inter on Saturday night. Gonzalo Higuain's ban reduced by one game, but he was unavailable to play. Was it a case of, I didn't see any of this, did they miss him?
Badly, yeah, they did. Their build-up play wasn't actually that bad for Napoli, particularly in the first half, but it was whenever they got to that final third, you could see that they were just, it was just missing Higuain, basically. They were reduced to shooting from range in the end, and really frustrating performance from Napoli, and you know the title clearly is gone now. And I have to say, from an Inter's perspective, Rob, they were very good. There was a great intensity about them. There was also a cleverness about their play. They scored with their first significant attack, Medel with the ball up to Icardi after 4 minutes, and that was his 15th league goal of the season. His conversion rate, by the way, is astonishing. He gets so little service, they create so little for him, but he still manages to score 15 goals in the season. I really think that he's turning into a very good centre, a very mature player with a good all-round game, only 23 as well, and he set up the second for Brozovic, who is another relatively young player who I think has still got developing to do, but is becoming very good under Mancini. But yeah, Napoli missed Higuain. Just no real cutting edge about them.
Let's talk about the reported bust-up between Luciano Spalletti and Francesco Totti at Roma, because there has been a bit of history between these two this season. There was one point where he exiled Totti from the first team squad after he spoke publicly about his disappointment at lack of playing time. What's the latest with this? I saw a new story the weekend, Adam.
Yeah, well, there's reports of quite a heated argument involved. Well, initially, so goes the story. Whether it's true, who knows? But the reports in Italy are that Spalletti really launched into the players after they'd drawn 3-3 at Atalanta, and that Totti basically spoke up for the players' side of things and disagreed in the dressing room with Spalletti, and then Spalletti apparently has sort of made it a little bit personal with Totti and aimed a few insults at him. But you know, the club have played it down; it's been denied. But so you know, we're never truly going to get to the truth, no. Are we? But what I would say about this whole issue between Spalletti and Totti is that basically Rome isn't big enough for both of them. One of them is going to have to go in the summer, and I think I know who my money is on in that respect, because I think Spalletti has the backing of Pallotta, the president, who sees that it, you know, he's got his man. He really seems to believe that Spalletti is the coach to move Roma on again after, you know, things had gone so well under Rudy Garcia, but then it just completely lost momentum. It all went sour. And Spalletti's had a very good start in Rome. I think, you know, with all this Totti business, we shouldn't lose sight of that. He's a great tactician, Spalletti, and I really think that he could do a good job there. But from Totti's point of view, look, his contract's up in the summer. He turns 40 in September, and time catches up with all of us, Rob, even Francesco Totti, and his iconic status means that I just don't simply think that he can sit there on the bench, and this season has proved that. Yes, he scored an important goal at the weekend. He got the equaliser after coming on as a sub, but he's only made 8 league appearances this season, and his role arguably would be even less next season. So I just think what's needed is a dignified parting of the ways. And I hope that happens because, you know, a player of his quality, with his longevity, his history with Roma, it would be such a shame if it all ended up in a real sour dispute, which is what it looks like is going to happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the quotes there. This is one quote that was in Gazzetta dello Sport that Spalletti allegedly said to Totti after he'd disagreed with the manager. Spalletti saying, "You shut up. You're not the one to talk when you go around the rooms playing cards until 2 a.m. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Never mind.
It's unfortunate, isn't it?
It is unfortunate. What's even more unfortunate, Adam, is the injury to Claudio Marchisio. And it looks like the Juve midfielder is going to miss the European Championships.
Yeah, I'm really sad about this because he's a brilliant player, Marchisio. He's done his knee ligaments, hasn't he? And what was a really easy win for Juventus against Palermo. And It reminds me, actually, of when they lost Montolivo, another central midfielder with a broken leg. Remember when he broke his leg at Craven Cottage?
Yeah, I was there for that game. Yeah.
Really sad that they've lost another central midfielder. I think he's had a great season, Marchisio. One, not without its injury problems, actually, but I think that Juventus are a much better side when he's in the team. They missed him badly at the start of the season. It was no coincidence for me that when he came back in, that things started to improve. I think Pogba was on record as saying that he missed him alongside him, and it helped Pogba's game. So, yeah, he's obviously going to get his hands on another league title, but he will be so bitterly disappointed to be missing the European Championships, and Italy will be a lesser side without him.
Adam, thanks so much for coming back on the podcast, mate, as always.
It's a pleasure, mate.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Okay, time for part two of the show now. Let's quickly mention the Bundesliga scores from the weekend, because there was a big drop-off in the teams battling for the Champions League spots anyway. Bayern and Dortmund guaranteed to finish in the top two, of course. But Leverkusen beat Eintracht Frankfurt 3-0. Elsewhere, Hertha lost, Gladbach lost, Mainz lost, and Schalke lost as well. So it seems everyone seems to be throwing that one away. Dortmund bouncing back from the shock defeat to Liverpool by getting past a rather poor Hamburg side 3-0. Lots of changes there. And 17-year-old Christian Pulisic getting on the score sheet as well. The United States international looking like a real find this season. Okay, let's look at Portugal next. And joining us from Portugal.net is founder Tom Kundert. Tom, great to have you on the show.
Okay, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem, mate. I've been wanting to get you on the show for quite some time. But let's start about the title race in Portugal. Yeah. I remember at the start of the season, I saw that many Sporting fans were feeling very smug about the fact that they'd taken Jorge Jesus from Benfica, and they won 3-0, I think, at the Luz, and then it looked like they were going to run away with the title. But Benfica have pulled themselves right back into it, and we'll talk about the game with Bayern in the Champions League in a moment. How has Rui Vitória got Benfica right back into this title race?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. At the start of the season, they looked like they'd be a long, long way from anywhere near the title, to be honest. They lost that game, you're absolutely right, 3-0 at home to Sporting in the league at the end of October, and that was actually one of three defeats by Sporting at the start of the season. They lost the Super Cup at season opener, And then they also lost in the Portuguese Cup a few weeks later. And there was actually quite a lot of contestation around Rui Vitória and even, you know, some of the Benfica fans and a lot of the analysts and the critics were saying maybe his days are numbered, maybe he's taken on a bit too much of a, you know, a big job because he'd come from a much smaller club in Vitória de Guimarães. But fair, you got to really hand it to him. He's just turned it round in really quite spectacular fashion. Since that defeat to Sporting, which was at the end of October, Benfica have just been on this incredible run in the league. They've actually played 22 games and won 20, drawn one, lost one. So, you know, gone to the top of the table. You've also got to give credit to Sporting for really, you know, keeping pace with them, for, you know, given that incredible run. But Sporting actually are back top because they played earlier this weekend. Got a scraped a 1-0 win at Moreirense on Saturday, which means they're 1 point clear. But Benfica, they can go back top if they win at home against Vitória de Setúbal tonight. And how has he done it? Well, it's just one thing which Benfica president has been really insisting on for quite a few years now is that he wanted to make use of the young Portuguese players and young foreign players as well in their B team. And that's the one criticism which Jorge Jesus, his Benfica years, that's one criticism he had. He didn't really utilise the young players. But, you know, Rui Vitória has been, he did that a lot at his previous club, Vitória Guimarães, very successfully. And he's been superb at Benfica. I mean, the likes of Renato Sanches, especially, Vitor Lindelof, the young Swedish centre-back, and Brazilian goalkeeper, Ederson, you know, they're all 20 or under 20 years old, 21, I think Lindelof is. And, you know, they've all been absolutely fantastic. And so got to hand it to Benfica. I think they're probably still favourites at this point in time, given the schedule for the rest of the season.
Part of Benfica's success as well this season has been down to the goals of Kostas Mitroglou and Jonas, but they were without them for the Champions League game against Bayern, which they drew 2-2, which meant elimination. But I saw some of your footage from the game, Tom, and it seemed that at the end of the game, would it be fair to say there was a real appreciation from the fans for what the players had attempted to do in defeating one of the best teams in Europe?
Without a doubt. That was, you know, managed to capture that the fans' reaction at the end of the game. You know, Benfica had just been knocked out and it was really, it's quite hair-raising, the atmosphere in the crowd. You know, every single Benfica fan, 65,000 of them, on their feet, giving the team, you know, a huge ovation to really, you know, show their appreciation for their efforts. And, you know, this is Bayern Munich. When the draw was made, most people, I think even most Benfica fans, to be honest, thought, OK, that's game over. Let's just see if we don't embarrass ourselves. And the game, you know, and as it turned out, you know, it's a well-fought tie. I think possibly I'd say the game in Bayern, especially, I think Benfica were really impressive, really kept, you know, in the game in Munich, really kept Bayern quiet. They even had two or three chances, you know, Jonas. Maybe we feel a bit disappointed he didn't put one of those away, and that could have made the tie even tighter. Back at Lisbon, you know, when that goal went in early on from Raul Jimenez, terrific header.
Lovely.
And and a fantastic cross by El Azil, terrific header, 1-1. And suddenly, you know, people were dreaming, could this really happen? But you've got to hand it to Bayern. You know, they also showed what a fantastic team they were. I don't think you can really argue with the justice of the result over the two legs. I thought Bayern, especially in Lisbon, you know, they were really impressive. But, you know, yeah, Benfica, really liking the league, completely exceeded expectations. I think getting that far in the Champions League and then the fight they put up against Bayern, really, you know, all Benfica fans are delighted. And they think their club's at a good place now. And, you know, you can't really argue with that.
As someone who's based in Lisbon, you're right at the heart of that title race in Portugal at the moment. And as we mentioned, battling it with Benfica is Sporting. One player I wanted to ask you about, Tom, is William Carvalho, because in England, certainly after he impressed at the Under-21 Championships, he was very heavily linked with a big money move, I think in particular to Arsenal, if memory serves you right. How's his form been this season under Jesus at Sporting? And is there any sign that they can hold on to him for a bit longer?
Yeah, well, he is, of course, he really burst onto the scene 2 seasons ago. He had an absolutely outstanding season in 2013-14. And he, even at that time, he was very heavily linked, curiously, to Arsenal. You know, a lot of, almost on a weekly basis, seemed to be getting his bags packed to, you know, yeah, head exactly. off to the Emirates. But he didn't go. And his form, to be fair, he's never quite reproduced the form of that season. Then he had a very good European Championships, like you said. He was actually voted most valuable player at that European Championships. Portugal came runners-up, losing to Sweden. And this season, he started the season off, actually came back injured from the tournament. And again, a bit like last season, never really hit that the same form. And he struggled a bit with fitness at the start of the season. But there are signs in the last couple of months that at last he's getting back to his very best. And he's been, especially in the last month or so, he's been very good again. So it's no real surprise that he's being linked to a move. Of course, he's such a powerhouse of a player, so strong physically, that you kind of think that you know, a Premier League move or, you know, playing football in the Premier League will certainly be no problem for him. I think he could thrive there.
I just put William Carvalho and Arsenal into Google and got more than 500,000 hits. So that gives you an idea of how much talk there had been previously about that. Can we talk about Porto, Tom? Because I wanted to ask you about Villas-Boas potentially going back, and I will in a moment. But I saw you tweeted out Pinto da Costa has been re-elected as Porto president, and it was unopposed, and it will be his 34th year, I think. Is that right? Why is no one challenging him? Is he doing such a good job in terms of the presidency at the club that no one's challenging him, or is he a bit of a all-conquering kind of guy?
Yeah, well, it's the second. The latter is definitely the reason. And his, of course, you know, his historical achievements are just unprecedented, I think, in all world football. People often forget when he was made Porto president. Curiously, it's actually 34 years to the day as his re-election yesterday. Porto were little more than a provincial club in Portugal, nothing like the powerhouse they are today. And I think they'd won the league 7 times in their history about the first maybe 40, 50 years of the Portuguese Championship. Since then, they've just absolutely dominated the last 3.5 decades. You know, they've won championship after championship, won, I think, 21 or 22 titles, the league titles in that time. Of course, won the European Cup in its former guise, won the Champions League in its new format. So he's completely revolutionised that club. And there's, because of that, he's almost really got unlimited credit, you could say. And so I think people are just too scared to stand against him. Of course, Porto, there are signs that their kind of empire is maybe a little bit on the wane. And Pinto da Costa himself is 78 years old. So, you know, obviously he can't go on forever. And there has been criticism, especially this season. It looked, well, definitely they're going to go now for a third straight season without winning the league. That's only happened once in Pinto da Costa's reign in the last 30 seasons. A lot of people connected to Porto are worried that this is more of a, you know, a long-term problem, because I think whereas that previous time when they went 3 seasons without winning the league, which was at the turn of the millennium. Sporting won twice, Boavista won once. This time, something's very different, and that is that both Sporting and Benfica especially are much, much stronger. And so it's going to be hard for them to get back to the top in Porto. So there has been criticism of him, notably from the ex-legendary Porto goalkeeper, Vitor Bahia. But also tellingly, you know, no one stands against him. He was unopposed yesterday. He was the only candidate. And, you know, I think people realised that because he's got this kind of unlimited credit, it would be really very, very difficult for anyone to be successful against him. Having said that, you know, if things continue to go wrong, I suppose that can change.
Is there any? Do you see Andre Villas-Boas going back? Because of course he had great success at Porto, winning the Europa League as well. And we've talked about him a lot on the show because we cover a lot of the Russian league and how he's leaving Zenit at the end of the season. Do you see Porto making a move to bring him back in the summer?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think he's talked quite openly about it, Andre Villas-Boas, that you know he'd like to return to Porto. When he does return to Portugal, or if he does return to Portugal, that's the only club he'd be interested in. And of course, Porto fans have got terrific memories of him. That side you mentioned, or that spell, it was just a one season spell he had at Porto, but it was probably, apart from the Jose Mourinho years, you know, you could argue one of the most successful seasons of all time for Porto. They were really fantastic. They won the league by, I think, 20 points or something ridiculous. They won the Europa League, you know, won the Cup. They just completely swept up the honours and playing really good football. Of course, they did have an amazing team. That was a team which had Hulk, Falcao, you know, when Falcao was unstoppable. João Moutinho, James Rodriguez, you know, all of those players in the same team.
It's so crazy to think now, isn't it? I mean, it's a strong lineup. Yeah.
It is. In Portugal, you could hardly imagine now, you know, because of this disparity in the amount of money between Portuguese league and other leagues. You can hardly imagine a team with that kind of quality in it. But, of course, I think if Andre Villas does come back, and no one would be surprised if it's this summer, I don't think he definitely won't have a team which has got such an obvious quality gap to the other Portuguese teams. And so I think it will make it for, you know, a very interesting season next season.
Tom, let's talk about a broader topic in terms of Portuguese football. Now, but in the official UEFA coefficient, which is sort of like how they rank what's the best league, essentially, based on how teams perform in Europe, Portugal is fifth in that list. And I saw you tweeting about this the other day, because the Portuguese league, despite having a competitive title race every year between three big teams, despite having well-performing teams in European competitions, it's rarely described as in Europe's big five. Why do you think that's the case?
Yeah, well,
I might have opened up a can of worms here, Tom. I don't know. So.
No, absolutely. I'm grateful for the opportunity, because this is a bit of a bugbear of mine, and also a lot of Portuguese supporters. It kind of gets ignored when, like you say, for many years, Portugal was fifth, got overtaken by France recently, but now it's reclaimed fifth place, you know, in the official UEFA rankings, which, as you say, is a kind of impartial way of measuring the strength of the league, because it's to do with the, you know, how well the clubs perform in European competitions. And you can see, you know, Portugal's clubs, I suppose mainly thanks to Porto this last decade, of course, they won the UEFA Cup, won the Europa League and the Champions League all in the last decade, or since 2004. But in that time, you know, Sporting have got to the final, Benfica got to the final twice, even Braga have got to the final. So you can really see that Portuguese clubs are very competitive. And I think if there was some kind of table which measured how competitive a team was compared to the money available or to the cost of their team, I'm pretty sure that Portugal would be on the top of that table every single year, because they really do kind of, you know, make the absolute most of their resources. Why does this happen? I think a lot of it, I suppose, has got to do with marketing. I think even here in Portugal, a lot of people, I think rightly, criticise the Portuguese football authorities because they don't really do a very good job of marketing the league, marketing their own league in Portugal, let alone abroad. Right. And so I think that's definitely one of the influences. Also, of course, there is one criticism of the Portuguese league, which is valid, which is you've got the big teams, which I think you can compete, and they've shown they can compete with, you know, the very best in Europe. But then when you get to the bottom half and the, you know, the lower part of the table, I think they are very, I wouldn't say they're very poor teams, they're awful teams, but in terms of their size and resources, you know, they're really tiny teams compared to, I suppose, the lowest teams in England and France and Germany. And it's very often you get, unfortunately, you get crowds in Portugal of barely 1,000, even sometimes under 1,000, you know, for top flight games when two of the smaller clubs play against each other. So I think that, obviously, maybe that kind of reflects on what wider league isn't so isn't looked at as so strong on the whole. But, if you just look at their best teams, I think there's no doubt about it. Portugal's best teams are, I suppose you could say, maybe top 10 and especially top 5 upwards. They can compete with any other league. And so people get a bit miffed when they're just completely ignored. You get all these articles on very good and reputable media outlets like Who Scored and Bleacher or whatever, and they all say so and so, who's got
most
the best
goals in the top 5 leagues.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Best tackle percentage in the top 5 leagues. no mention at all of Portugal. So, maybe that would change. It's quite an interesting time in Portuguese football, also because for the first time in many years, well, first time ever. To be fair, the Portuguese TV revenue there's been a massive hike in the amount of money that the clubs would be receiving, which a massive hike, I say, by Portuguese standards. It's still probably a bit of a drop in an ocean by drop in the ocean compared to the Premier League or something like that. But a lot of people say this is going to have a big effect in Portuguese football. Maybe not so much. Well, first of all, the bigger teams may be able to hold on to their players a little bit longer, before they get snapped up by the big European sharks. But a lot of people say, and I think it's a very valid point, that kind of the mid-level teams, the ones I was just talking about, and also the lower-level teams, might be able to get a higher quality of player. And so that will also make the whole league more competitive. So it's going to be an interesting time, I think, the next few years in Portugal.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. A final one from me, Tom, on Cristiano Ronaldo. He's getting a lot of love at the moment for what he's doing with Real Madrid and in particular for his hat-trick against Wolfsburg in the Champions League. And we've spoken at length on the show about his apparent decline or whatever way you want to look at it. What condition do you think Cristiano Ronaldo is in at the moment? Because, we think back to the last World Cup, I don't even think he was fit. Was he in the last World Cup? So how do you think Ronaldo's looking? How is he viewed in Portugal at the moment?
Yeah, well, it's amazing, isn't it, that I think probably like everyone, people thought maybe he was slightly on decline this season. He's going to hit 50 goals again. That's not bad, is it?
It's not bad.
Someone is on the decline. And he looks in great form. So obviously, of course, people in Portugal are delighted about that. He's obviously a huge source of pride for Portuguese people. And I think in terms of the European Championships now, the Euro coming up, it's going to be, people are really getting quite excited about this. Ronaldo, you could say, is quite an interesting thing about when you look at his international career. He's a little bit unlucky in one sense, is that his career or the prime of his career has just fallen between two fantastic Portuguese generations. When he burst onto the scene, it was just at the end of, Figo. Luis Figo, Rui Costa were really just coming out to the end of their careers, didn't quite catch them at their best. And now people in Portugal are getting very excited because there's a lot of really high quality Portuguese footballers coming up. I mean, we just talked about William Carvalho, Bernardo Silva, the Monaco creative midfielder. I think he's going to be a fantastic player. He's going to end up at one of the biggest clubs in the world, without a doubt. André Gomes at Valencia, another really top-class talent. And then you've got players emerging in Portugal like João Mário at Sporting and Renato Sanches at Benfica.
Yeah, so great,
especially in midfield, Portugal really do look like they're going to have a fantastic, fantastic upcoming few years. And actually, Ronaldo himself said, since he's been in the Portuguese side, he can never remember such high-quality young players all coming through. So, it's going to be very exciting. I think if Ronaldo can really be at his peak, like you said, 2014 World Cup, he was injured. And, that was a disaster for Portugal. Quite a few of their players were injured. But, of course, Ronaldo, the main one, wasn't at his peak. So if he can stay fit and be at his best at Euro 2016, maybe Portugal could just pull off a surprise there.
Maybe they can. Tom, absolutely great to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. No problem.
This is Football in Europe, Liga Roundup.
Joining us now for part three of the show is French football journalist and commentator Jonathan Johnson. Jonathan, thanks for coming back on, mate.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me on.
You're in the office. There's some high-level stuff going on in the background.
Yeah, exactly. Typical Monday morning in Paris.
Well, let's start by talking about Paris Saint-Germain and Laurent Blanc, because to what extent has he been under pressure since the elimination in the Champions League to Manchester City?
Oh, hugely. You know, I think I wouldn't go as far as saying it was all his fault that PSG got knocked out of the Champions League, but I think his decision to move away from the 4-3-3 and play, you know, completely untried, untested formation in that second leg against City was a massively influential factor in PSG's elimination. I mean, okay, PSG were missing a number of players for that game and it made it difficult for Blanc to play his 4-3-3, but it wasn't like it was impossible for him to go out with his regular formation. And I think because PSG are so used to playing in that style, I think that any team he put out in that formation would have put up stiff resistance against City. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, PSG only lost 1-0, but they barely created any chances. Zlatan had two free kicks that forced Hart to make two saves and Cavani missed a sitter. Comme d'habitude, really, with Cavani. But apart from that, PSG didn't really create enough. You know, Di Maria was played in the middle of sort of like a 3-4-1-2 formation, but it wasn't. Yeah. If he was played in the middle of the 4-3-3 like we saw from him against Caen at the weekend when PSG absolutely, you know, thrashed them, I think we would have seen Di Maria be more influential. And really, he was the key of the game for PSG, and the formation that Blanc selected didn't get the best out of him. And now PSG are faced with a season of, you know, stagnation, really, because at best it can now only be a repeat of last season.
I was stunned when I saw the team selection come in, because the managers have to submit the official formation they're going to play to UEFA, otherwise they get in a bit of trouble. And when we saw it was three at the back, just absolutely amazed. And Jonathan, looking back to even say a month ago, there was a lot of love for Laurent Blanc and the way he'd gone about winning the title in such convincing fashion, and his relationship with Ibrahimovic and how he's handled the Serge Aurier situation. But some of the front pages, particularly of L'Équipe of late, I've seen, you know, is he in serious risk of losing his job this summer if he doesn't deliver titles other than the league, which he's already won?
I definitely think that if PSG were to fail to win one or both, really, I think, of the domestic cups, now that they're out of the Champions League, I think that he really is in danger. I said all along, after he signed the 2-year contract, that that really was a move from QSI to try and keep things calm as possible for Blanc and for the players going into the latter stages of the Champions League.
Ah, very interesting.
And okay. I think that that was a tactic of theirs to try to make sure that there was no speculation over Blanc's future, because I think at the end of the day, a 2-year contract for Blanc is, you know, it's not impossible for PSG's paymasters to pay that off if they decide that results aren't adequate enough. But obviously, there would have to be a better candidate, at least in QSI's mind, on the market if they were to split with Blanc. But you know, their hand might be forced if PSG were to lose one or both of these domestic cups. Now, at the beginning of the season, Blanc was talking about perhaps letting one of the cups go, in order to prioritise progress in the Champions League, and it seemed like PSG's leaders were on board with that. But now that they've gone out to the Champions League, you know, I think the goalposts probably have changed, and PSG's leaders will be expecting a repeat of last season, with the sort of the added bonus, I would say, of the fact that PSG tied up the league in such convincing style this season compared to last season, where they were very complacent and they only won it in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I find that very interesting, what you say about the contract for Blanc. And I felt Manchester City actually did exactly the same thing with Pellegrini, to just put all talk of his future to bed for a few months, Not that that really worked because the Pep Guardiola thing happened. So they tried. But Paris Saint-Germain have a lot of cup action this week. So what have we got on, Jonathan?
Well, we've got the semi-final against Lorient in Coupe de France coming up tomorrow, so Tuesday. And then on the Saturday, they have the League Cup final, Coupe de la Ligue against Lille. So two exciting games. I would expect that PSG would get to the final of the Coupe de France. But going into the Coupe de la Ligue, I think that is a real potential banana skin for PSG. You look at the way that Lille are playing at the moment, really made a massive improvement under Frédéric Antonetti. There are players in that that Lille side that are going to pose PSG problems at the weekend, I feel.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, on one of those players, the last player... a player who's ripping it up at the moment is Eder, who I last saw at Goodison Park. I can't remember, back in January, I think it was, not get a kick for Swansea, came in for the final seconds, and then I saw him eating a Burger King at Liverpool Lime Street Station minutes after the full time. But he, in Ligue 1, he's been brilliant of late, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. He's been absolutely fantastic, and I think that it would be unfair to say that Eder's transfer has completely changed the Lille side. I think that you'd also have to look at the fact that Amalfitano came in as well. And a combination of those two. Frédéric Antonetti and the motivation that he's given his players since taking over from Hervé Renard, and also Sofiane Boufal, who we've talked about before, who is a fantastic talent, recently chosen to represent Morocco at international level. He is a very, very exciting player to watch when you're thinking about, the sort of next big talents emerging in Ligue 1. Scored a hat-trick over the weekend against Gazalec Ajaccio, so he's really coming into that PSG game, with plenty of confidence and, perhaps a point to prove to PSG as well, because they've been linked with a move for him in the summer. Looks like they're going to prefer Hatem Ben Arfa of Nice at the moment, probably because, he's available on a free transfer and they'd have to pay upwards of 20 million euros in order to get hold of Boufal. But there are, the likes of Boufal, Eder, who are, going to pose PSG some problems at Stade de France, I feel. And, I think that those two in particular are the two danger men that PSG are going to have to watch out for.
Let's talk about Marseille, Jonathan, because a lot's happened in the last 7 days. The club's been put up for sale. And I remember last week, they lost again at the weekend. They were beaten by Monaco. I was watching their game on TV where they drew 0-0 with Bordeaux, and the fans were clashing with police in the stands. It's all been coming to this, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. This is the culmination of many years now of really bad mismanagement. You look at the situation with Aston Villa in the Premier League. It's sad to see such a big club drop out of the top flight. And it's a similar situation to Marseille. Obviously not quite as bad at Marseille at the moment, but the fact that they're still only 6 points away from the drop zone with a couple of matches left to play, it is unlikely that they go down, but it is still also a possibility. And it's just been a wretched, wretched season for them. Michel doesn't even want to be coach of this team. He's offered, he basically asked to be sacked in a crisis meeting recently. And the club owner, Margarita Louis-Dreyfus, said no. And then she's put the club up for sale. And basically the season can't come to an end quickly enough for Marseille. There is perhaps some silver lining, if Marseille beats Sochaux in the Coupe de France semi on Wednesday, then they could be setting up a potential final against maybe even bitter rivals PSG, and there'd be no greater motivation for them after the horrible season that they've had. If they could go to Stade de France, beat PSG, and give the fans something to cheer about, perhaps going into the summer, and then they can hope for a buyout and potentially brighter days in the future. But it really is dark times at Stade Velodrome at the moment. The football on the pitch has been poor this season after the excitement that Marcelo Bielsa brought, and it's very difficult to see how things are going to improve unless the club changes hands and the leadership at the very top is completely changed.
Let's talk about a bit of admin in terms of Ligue 1. They're bringing back a relegation playoff, which is something that we have in the Bundesliga in Germany. It barely ever sees the team from the top tier relegated. They play a team from Bundesliga 2, and always the Bundesliga team wins. So what's the plan with this one? Is it the same type of thing, Jonathan?
Yeah, it is. And I think the reasoning behind this is that it would make Ligue 1 sides... a bit more attractive to potential investors, because obviously investors would be put off by the potential of three teams being relegated, you know, especially at, you know, some investors that might want to buy into a team like Marseille, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think this is a move that will, you know, perhaps see a few more investors start to take a more serious look at some of the teams in Ligue 1. But obviously, it's going to impinge the ability of some of those teams in Ligue 2 to get into the top flight. I mean, I'm thinking particularly teams like Bob Bradley's Le Havre, for example, a team who, you know, when they get to the top flight, will have a bit of money behind them. But it's just that they can't really use that money at the moment in Ligue 2. So they really need to get themselves into one of those automatic promotion spots or get themselves up this season before those rules come in, you know, in order to, you know, perhaps make an impact in on French football. You know, I think that this is, you know, something that we'll see in the coming years as well. You know, some of these clubs that, you know, have a bit of money to spend in Ligue 2, they're really going to have to give absolutely everything to finish in those top two positions, because it will be, like you said, it's difficult to see the team from the top flight that go into that playoff game to determine who, you know, who's going to go to Ligue 2, or, you know, who's going to come into Ligue 1, or who's going to stay where they are. You know, losing that match, considering the advantage that they have of, you know, having been in the top flight for the whole season.
Jonathan, just a final one before we let you go. I feel like we talk about Karim Benzema every time you're on the show, but over the past week, he himself has confirmed that he won't be going to the European Championships. You said on Football in Europe previously that you thought it was very unlikely and there was no way back for Karim Benzema. But there appeared to be a little glimmer of light for him in terms of getting selected that was sort of taken away. Did I read that wrong? I thought there was a chance he might have been back in contention.
Yeah, there was a chance. You know, he is able to associate now with Mathieu Valbuena, and I think people assume that automatically he'd be called up for the latest France squad. But it was up to the French Football Federation to, you know, basically stop banning him from being called up. They hadn't. You know, they then decided to speak with Didier Deschamps and try and decide, you know, the way forward for Benzema and the French national team. The decision that they came to in the end altogether was that Benzema won't play any part in the Euros. You know, so yeah, that small shred of hope doused, really, for Benzema. It is possible that he will return in the future, you know, thinking of the World Cup in 2018. Whether or not he wants to after what's happened, you know, that's another question entirely. But I think he will be considered for selection again in the future, just not in time for the Euros. But, you know, I have to say that, you know, people should still be excited about watching France in the Euros, even without Benzema in that team. You know, I think that I got a lot of stick for putting my opinion out there by saying that the actual team itself won't miss Benzema. And obviously, you know, not having a player of his quality at the tournament will be, a miss. But this is a player who rarely ever replicates his Real Madrid form for the French national team. You know, when you look at his goal-scoring record as well in international tournaments, you know, he's played in, I think he's played in three international tournaments. He's only scored three goals at international tournaments, and they all came in the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, in the group stages of that, no less, as well.
Right.
And this is just a player who, you know, is quite simply not the same player for his country as he is for his club. And I think because of that, and you look at the form that some other attacking players are in at the moment, you know, the likes of Antoine Griezmann, you know, I think that France don't have to worry as much as they might have done a couple of months ago about missing Karim Benzema. And I think Griezmann in particular could really benefit from this, because you look at the way that he plays through the middle when he's playing with Diego Simeone's Atletico Madrid side. And I think that this this move could really benefit him, and could see him become the star of this French team for the Euros on home soil.
Jonathan, really great, as always, to have you on the show. Thank you very much for coming back on, mate.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me on.
That's all we have time for on Football in Europe this week. Don't forget to keep your tweets coming in using @FIEPodcast, and please leave us a review on iTunes. We're back next Monday.
This is Football in Europe.